Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 391.RV2101, certificate number 46819, Earth 2.
We're looking at another dimension. Live.
It's just like ours.
Almost, but their flash is still alive.
So's their Luthor.
There's something else. They don't call themselves the Justice Lords. They're the Justice League.
Not Biosphere 2.
Not Earth also.
Yeah, not Earth as well. Earth T-O-O. Earth hyphen T... No, wait. No. Earth hyphen T-W-O.
T-W-O. Second Earth. Alternate Earth.
Do you think about alternate Earths?
You have to, because if you are interested in...
You don't have to.
Well,
it's not compulsory. Nobody comes to your house.
No, but you know, at a certain point, you follow along in the physics trades, and you're like, I love, you know, lol, I'm loving this energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. And then you get to string theory.
Then you get to quantum
physics. And you have
physics.
To just stand there at the door and go, do I really want to walk through here? The problem is I can't not, because I don't want to be like a truther, a one world truther.
Do your reflections on the quantum realm boil down? Or, you know, I guess boil up into how you see your life and the universe.
Yeah.
Do you think about what parallel universe John Roderick is doing if he had not, dodged that truck in Istanbul or?
No, I mean, that stuff feels pretty comic booky. I mean, the
oh, we're going to get comic booky.
The multiverse thing seems, it's less interesting to me as like, what if I could go through a door and meet like evil John who actually has eyebrows.
He has no beard. It's the opposite of the Spock thing.
But, or maybe I'm evil John.
Whoa.
Oh no.
You do have the beard.
But you know, just the suggestion, I don't know. Suggestion, what am I talking about? The suggestions. It's certainly a lot to sit and ponder.
Has it been too colored by a certain kind of pop culture for you to take it seriously? Because it's a science fiction trope, you disdain the nerdery of it?
No, I mean, I'm still trying to grapple with the physics, which it's way above my pay grade.
So you can't even get into the existential dilemmas of it because...
No, because I'm still just trying to figure out what. I mean, there are some things about it I love. I love spooky action at a distance. I love it when particles...
You almost said spooky action at a dick.
I love spooky action at a dick.
Is that the theme of your Halloween party this year?
No, it's
the hamburger.
Yeah, it describes my order at Dick's Hamburgers. Can I get a spooky action at a distance with fries? I love the conundrum. I love the thought experiment, but I love a thought experiment that I actually can take somewhere. Mm. And the problem with quantum is that I get into the math weeds and I don't understand.
Right.
And so then I just feel dumb and I don't like feeling dumb.
It's all very hypothetical. You know, when you try to explain this stuff, even at a simple level, you really just have to say, just take my weird word for it. Stuff
just take my
weird
for it. Take I'm going to start saying that. Look, just take my word for it.
Song title.
Yeah, like stuff is just going to get weird. So just let me tell you about particles and waves, and it's going to sound wrong, but just assume it's not. And that's a tough foundation for a field, right?
Yeah. Or at a in a world of infinite possibilities in a Hilbert hotel of math, it starts to seem like things are undifferentiatable. Certainly, like it's hard to, because a lot of this stuff is interesting to me because of how it affects making moral arguments about things, discovering right and wrong, like parsing out culpabilities, and at a point at which all things are infinitely possible, it's harder than to, maybe not harder to make a case, it's just irrelevant to making certain cases. And I'm somebody that loves the idea of a unified theory. And so I don't want something in physics to be incompatible with the idea that you should be good to people, or if not incompatible, at least like I don't want something in physics to
be agnostic about it.
Yeah, to be agnostic about it. I want there to be a unit.
Isn't that the trend in physics?
It is. And the problem is I'm not religious, right? So the solution for me would be, well, find a religion that it will make a case
just
for...
Just give up on being nice to people and become a libertarian.
There's that, too. I could make that choice. I stand at the crossroads and don't know which way to go.
So we're all at the crossroads. All these decisions we make affect the timeline we live in. And we don't think of, you know, today we might think of them as timelines. You know, previous generations just would have said, that's the journey of my life. But the thought experiment is, what if you chose a different thing? You know, what if there could be libertarian John branching off from this moment and making angry podcasts about the free market?
Oh, I hate that guy. I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, he will lose a lot of friends for sure.
No, the problem is he probably won't. He'll probably gain a bunch of new followers. I just don't want to be that guy.
It's a tempting way to think of your life. The thing about a unified theory is it simplifies things. But a lot of the implications of quantum theory are that the universe is infinitely more complex even than it seems, that one universe is much too small to contain it all. What if there were a near infinite number of universes? What if there was a multiverse?
What if?
One of them, so, and this has seeped into popular culture as well, less through science and more through science fiction.
Oh, science fiction, the new science.
it's better than science, I guess, or at least makes more at the box office.
The trouble with tribbles.
The Earth 2, the particular alternate universe I want to introduce you to.
Go on.
Dates back. You're laughing already. You're sneering at Earth 2 already.
Because your setup, you're like, this isn't science, but science adjacent.
It dates back to 1961.
Oh, a good year.
One of the most influential comic book writers of the early years of the 20th century.
This is the...
I'm going to keep track of how many times you say, here we go.
Here's one.
There's one tick on the paper.
This is Omnibus in a nutshell. You're just trying to bring your comic book, your room full of comic book omnibuses into the show and make this show the same as your room full.
I feel like we never talk about... We don't talk about nerd culture that much. Like, how often has Star Trek even come up on this show?
Do we not? I guess we don't.
What's the nerdiest one so far? I don't know. It's probably some math thing. It's Hilbert Hotel.
Well, let's go. Let's go. Here we go.
This is the...
Write it down. I said it twice.
The first and last science fiction related omnibus.
Here we go down into the Marvel Comics universe.
No, DC.
We're in DC. Oh, okay. Then I'm bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Wait, what? You're a Spider-Man kid.
No, the thing is, I don't hear as much about DC, so I'm not as worn down.
This is a very... Exactly. So we're living in a culture right now that's currently... overwhelmed by superhero comics as mass culture.
I am a Spider-Man kid, by the way. I was the only superhero comic I could read.
This is a weird little niche of 20th century comics that I think is not super well reflected in what we think of as the superhero boom of the early 21st century. Gardner Fox was a very influential and prolific writer of the pulps. Mm-hmm. Back then, these kind of sciencey kids could make a good living writing for these cheap, astounding space thrills kind of magazines that would need just thousands of new words every month. And there was a big audience of it was the pre-nerd era, but there was a big audience of sciencey kids. that wanted to read about laser battles.
Well,
and
you
stuff.
Remember when Marty McFly first goes back in time to 1955 in his DeLorean, and he crashes into the barn, and his protective fallout suit flops down over his eyes, and the farmer and his family come running out to see what happened. The little kid is clutching a pulp magazine with a picture of a UFO on it, and it looks just like Marty McFly in a DeLorean, and thus begins our wild adventure.
A lot of people were raised on that. In the movie, George McFly is a big fan of the pulps, and that's
he becomes a writer of them, right?
Right, and that's because Marty disguises as Darth Vader from Planet Vulcan, and it changes his.
Of course, Darth Vader from Planet Vulcan.
I guess because there was really not a whole lot of children's entertainment. You know, you couldn't come home and watch children's TV, so you were really limited to things like the Sunday comics, where Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers were shooting lasers.
Right.
And the radio, where there would be, other kinds of pulp heroes.
The Shadow
and the Lone Ranger and Green Hornet. And maybe, are there science fiction-y ones? I'm not sure.
Well, there's War of the Worlds. I guess that's lit, but... Well, it was lit, man.
that was a crazy night.
What about Orson Welles's broadcast?
Yeah. It was War of the Worlds.
Right.
It was a H.G. Wells adaptation.
But I'm just now, it's occurring to me, when George McFly got to be middle-aged...
Did he go to Star Wars?
Well, did he wonder, like, wait a minute, when Star Trek came on the television, only a few years, like 10 years later,
yeah.
And he saw...
Planet Vulcan,
he was like, wait a minute...
I think I would accept that as a coincidence. Vulcan is a Roman god like all the other planets.
But then
when Darth Vader shows up,
sure,
he's going to start to figure it out. He's going to piece it together.
Right.
There's a Crispin Glover sequel I'd like to see.
That would be a nice little fanfic.
Anyway, Gardner Fox was very much one of these science-y kids. By all accounts, he just had a house full of books, file cabinets full of facts. And if you read his pulp stories or later his comic work, it's just full of whatever he was interested at the time. Exploration of the Arctic or weird old-timey coins or black holes. He kept up with the latest erudition, mm-hmm. A National Geographic kind of a guy. If you read his Silver Age comics, I think he was the one that always had in his comics about the Flash, DC Comics' super-powered speedster character, he would often have Flash facts that talked about different actual science-related implications of the speed of sound, the speed of light, different kind of physics kind of stuff. Like, he thought he would educate the New Frontier kids, or New Frontier kids, they might have said,
on our
new Sputnik era world. But in the golden age of superheroes, which kind of began with the first appearance of Superman in 1938, Gardner Fox wrote a ton of those early comics. He created the original Flash, who mm-hmm. was college student Jay Garrick. Some kind of accident involving heavy water gives him the power to move very fast.
Huh.
He created Hawkman. He created Dr. Fate. And his big innovation was to tie a lot of these characters together into one comic, The Justice Society of America. In 1940, Gardner Fox debuted in All-Star Comics number 3. The first time that any of these heroes would hang out and fight crime together. So the idea of a shared universe where all of your fictional favorites might hang out, this is, second nature to us today. But
yeah.
he kind of had to invent it from the whole cloth in 1940 because nobody at the time had ever been like, but what if Dracula, actually knew Dr. Frankenstein?
But it seems like the fashion to connect universes and to say that the South Park universe shares a universe with the Seinfeld universe because of one thing that appeared in the background.
It all goes back to St. Elsewhere. It's all that kid with the snow globe on St. Elsewhere.
I mean, that's fairly recent, right? Or what was that? Did that happen during the run of St. Elsewhere, or was it something that was retroactively imposed on self?
I think this is one of many a case, and we're going to see other tropes like this during this entry of a science fiction trope, people being aware of different timelines and fictional universes actually crossing over into each other, people taking those sci-fi tropes and applying them to the other popular entertainment.
Are we going to talk about the Tommy Westfall universe, or should we save that for another episode?
Is that a whole omnibus? We should decide now. I don't know. I don't know if it is.
Maybe.
It's the crux of it is that...
it's all a dream.
In the last episode of St. Elsewhere, a 1980s hospital drama St. Elsewhere, the whole show is kind of implied to be happening in the head of a possibly autistic or epileptic
autistic
kid.
Boy.
Yeah, who has a little snow globe that containing a hospital. The problem is that St. Elsewhere crossed over with Cheers. At one point, both
which
shows taking place in Boston.
Cheers is also in the snow globe.
All 200 episodes of Cheers took place in Chad Allen's snow globe. And then other shows crossed over with Cheers, like all the Frasiers, and then everybody who met Frasier, and then it eventually gets you to dozens or even hundreds of television shows. I think it goes through Richard Belzer a lot. Because he plays the same character on many TV shows.
Right.
Anyway, but that's the same kind of impulse, like... Instead of just considering this as a work of art, what if it's a whole world that's happening somewhere before the book started and after the book ended? What would the implications of that be? And I don't think that's a way we have thought of art much, at least in, say, the post-Enlightenment era. Maybe the ancient Greeks, you know, would have... They had their own kind of continuity right. issues, trying, you know, the Romans trying to figure out which of their gods were actually the Greek gods.
Right.
The Greeks trying to get different stories to fit together.
And the Greeks often trying to incorporate... actual real world wars yes. and events yes. into a kind of their pantheonic legends.
So for them, it was semi-real. And I don't know if that's the same impulse as us trying to take some of our favorite works of art or entertainment and say, actually, they all know, what if they knew each other?
Well, increasingly, I think for people, it is real because those fictional universes are becoming very real to yes. them. That's where, I mean, they inhabit those worlds as much as they do their own.
And we would romanticize that in the old days, you know, a kid just dreaming over the Sunday comics or thinking about what if Dracula met Tarzan, you know, we right. kind of think that's, you know, a fun mental adventure. And today maybe we're seeing the apotheosis of it where we think, are we spending too much time in these fictional universes? Like, is the world going to hell while I think about whether Spider-Man's allowed to be in the next Avengers movie?
We're certainly in a period now where it feels like, and particularly with the rise of Comic-Cons and cosplays and so forth, that it's too early to tell what the future holds and whether or not there becomes a Marvel-verse that lives in the world.
Right.
I mean, if there are enough people cosplaying as people in the Spidey-verse, how long before they just start going to work that way, and how long before you don't have a diverse workplace unless you have one Spider-Man?
What if it actually starts to surface in our reality, like a Borges short story in which people have imagined the Marvel universe in more detail than our own, and it supplants us in some way? Like it actually starts to grow outward.
Here's my question: how do you fit into the Spideyverse, Ken?
Oh, I've never been into the Spideyverse.
No, but I mean, if the Spideyverse becomes the universe,
oh, I see.
What are you? Are you just somebody that is walking the streets as some various Spidey?
I feel like I maintain the fan page.
No, but inside the Spideyverse, like right. inside the
Spideyverse.
Well,
I live in New York.
Oh,
the Spideyverse is all Manhattan.
I get it.
I going to do from Seattle? Am I going to?
There's going to be a Seattle Spideyverse if there are multiverses.
Sure. There can be one in which we got all the superheroes. Instead of, what's the guy we have? Phoenix Jones. Seattle actually had the groundbreaking
actual real-life superhero.
Yeah. Who would, I don't know if he was climbing walls, but he was trying to break up fights and whatnot.
Stop crime.
Gotta stop crime. So Gardner Fox continues, you know, superheroes go out of style at some point in the 1950s. Gardner Fox continues to write for DC, but it's not until the mid-50s that superheroes start to make a recovery. Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman are published continuously from the 1940s into the 1950s, but the bloom is really off the rose, and the kids are not buying millions of Batman comics like they were during the heyday, you know, around World War II. I think World War II was a huge boom for comics. Lots of bored young American men overseas looking for something to read at various levels of education.
Right.
And here's a market where you can sell the millions of Superman comics. They would love to see Superman or Captain America punching Hitler. You can see why so many of those stories kind of had a military bent.
Right.
But the superheroes kind of fade. And in 1956, it's one DC Comics editor, Julius Schwartz, who brings back superheroes.
And does it how? How are the superheroes sold to the next gen?
New titles, new identities. You know, what if there was a Flash, but it wasn't Jay Garrick, the college student that we read about 15 years ago? What if it's kind of a younger, hipper, crew-cutted policeman named Barry Allen working in his police lab when lightning strikes some chemicals and gives him speed powers? So it uses all the old tropes, but it kind of updates it for the Eisenhower era.
Right.
There's a new Green Lantern and he's a space cop. Right. It's not a mystical thing.
There's a new Robin and he's like a Dobie Gillis beatnik who's
there actually was some that was mostly on the Marvel side.
Oh, right.
You know, in 1961, the same year in which Earth 2 is born, of course, Stan Lee and his collaborators like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko begin a kind of a new, kind of funnier, hipper competing wave of superheroes over at Marvel. And these are not your dad's square Superman and Batman with their clubhouses and their pals and their dogs. Like, these guys actually have real troubles and real jokes and quips. And it's, right. it seems it's definitely geared at emerging American teen culture.
And it took DC another two decades to come up with the Dark Knight and the Batman that's truly bad.
We will get to that. Yeah. DC never really becomes the face of American youth culture until kind of embracing a darker, grittier version of the superhero in the 1980s.
So why the heck was DC so squeaky clean? What's going on over there? Why? What do they got to hide that they don't have?
That's your impulse? Well, they're making nice comics about nice superheroes. Clearly, they're killing drifters.
What I loved about Spider-Man was he was a teenager, and and Spider-Man comics were funny in the 60s. I mean, I found all those stacks of my friend's older brother's Spidey comics and loved him. He was hilarious.
He tells
really
jokes
snarky.
And the villains get mad.
Yeah.
They'll be like, Spider-Man. And he'll say, it ain't Albert Schweitzer.
Sure. It's not whistling macaroni and cheese.
And they'll be so mad that he's making fun of them while they're trying to do their crimes.
Yeah, he makes fun of them while they do crimes.
That didn't happen over at DC. Batman and Superman made treasure hunts for each other.
Yeah, they were just like, da, da, da.
And it's irony-free. They all have boy sidekicks, and nobody ever, like, kind of turns a side eye on that.
No, the whole world over there just was too earnest for me.
And in the 60s, when the counterculture embraces it, it becomes the Batman TV show where they amp up the campy, kitschy quality.
Right. Well, I liked that. That was
right.
A fun
like
show.
That's a fun use of it.
Kapow!
But the funny thing is, like, they kind of reinvented superheroes for teens in the 50s. They just, you know, teen culture was emerging, so they did not yet have the advantage of having...
They didn't get all the way up to Christian Archie.
They didn't get up to slang, even. Right. You know, they just had... they got up to square malt shop Archie when you get Barry Allen and Hal Jordan and all these guys. So Barry Allen, the new Flash, lives in Central City, not Keystone City like his 40s equivalent.
Uh-huh.
But except for that, he has the same kind of superpowered adventures. Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman continue to exist, and they know this new generation of hero as well. In September of 1961... Gardner Fox, who had written a lot of these 40s comics, writes a landmark issue of the Flash's comic, Flash number 123. This is the guy that gave us the Justice Society of America, superheroes crossing over. And he one-ups that with his story, which he calls Flash of Two Worlds.
Oh.
This is still a beloved Silver Age comic book, which would sell for $5,000 or more today if you could find a nice copy. I know my dad is still convinced that he has a copy of Flash of Two Worlds someplace.
What?
It was like when he threw out all his comics, this was the one that meant a lot to him and he held on to
it. Is it worth money?
If his was in good shape, it could be worth thousands. His is probably not in good shape if it exists. But I remember as a kid, him going through boxes, seeing if he could find his copy of Flash of Two Worlds for me. People remember this. It was a real watershed for a certain kind of sci-fi kid of that generation. What happens in Flash of Two Worlds is this Flash, in addition to running fast, can vibrate his molecules at super speeds.
Oh, I remember this.
This lets him he can pass through walls and whatnot because he'll vibrate out of phase with matter.
Sure.
I don't know if that's possible or not. I know this is going to trouble your unified theory.
No, I believe it. I'll go along with that.
Here we go.
Because I'm always talking to my daughter about look, solids look solid, but they're not solids.
Sure.
You got your atoms, and she's like...
You feel like you're touching this, but you're never really touching,
she's
man.
She's like, what are you talking about? We talked about it the other day because she did the old salt on ice experiment.
Oh, that's fun.
And she was like, it's colder. And I'm like, I know, right? Because the atoms are doing stuff.
So the Flash can pass through walls by vibrating his molecules. In this particular story, he vibrates his molecules so much he winds up in a different dimension entirely.
Okay, now why?
He has moved out of phase with our universe, apparently.
Sure.
And on a different vibrational resonance.
Strange quirks.
In the same space as our universe, as his central city, there's a different place. And this place turns out to be Keystone City, where Jay Garrick, the 1940s Flash, operated.
Oh, so wait a minute. So when Flash was transmuted in the 60s to what was the city that he lived in?
He went from Central City to Keystone City.
Was the new city. But was when he went through the time portal or the space portal, did he end up in Central City or Keystone City?
So he's from Central City.
He's from Central City.
And he winds up in Keystone City.
But when he was in Central City, was there ever any reference to Keystone City? Or was it one of these like hand-waving, now he always lived here?
There are some kind of Tommy Westfall implications of this, as we shall see. But yeah, but there was never any mention to the fact that there was a previous Flash at all until this moment.
So now we meet previous Flash.
Right. And he finds, by looking through a phone book, he finds out that Jay Garrick, the old Flash, is retired. I think has married his girlfriend from those comics and is living happily in retirement. And so our two Flashes have to team up to fight three criminals, the Shade, the Fiddler, and the Thinker, that are wrecking havoc with a crime spree in old-timey Keystone City.
But now we, the viewers, are able to see and comprehend the two universes. Where do we sit?
Okay, well, that's going to come up as well.
What city are we?
We're in a different universe entirely, John.
I see. Okay,
and that starts to be hinted at here, because here's the even crazier thing than two comic books that you know of can meet in story and be in different universes, but still hang out through kind of hand wavy science. But there's a second layer, which is that when Barry Allen, the Flash, meets Jay Garrick, he doesn't just say, oh, right, you were the Flash from 15 years ago, or I don't know about you because you're in a different universe. What he actually says is, oh, I read about your stories in the 40s.
So he's a fiction Flash.
Yes. Within Barry Allen's universe, Jay Garrick is a comic character from the previous generation.
So wait a minute. So Flash number two, who read about earlier Flash as a comic story from his childhood.
Yes.
When he got electrified and became the Flash, does he ever refer to the fact that I just took on all the comic book appurtenances?
You'd think he would have, right? You'd think there would be a... And today, if you were writing today, there would definitely be a nod to, hey, I'm going to be like one of these comic book heroes you see in movies.
I'm going to put on a felt headdress that I made.
But that was 5 years earlier. It was a different writer. Nobody had thought of connecting the two. In fact, that would have been anathema because... We want to appeal to new teens. We're not going to mention their dad's World War II era stuff.
Right.
So it's only when Gardner Fox, the guy who wrote some of the old ones, comes on board that he thinks it would be fun to tie in his old stories. And there is an in-story explanation for how this second universe could exist as a fictional element in the first. And it's dumb, you know, it's hand-wavy. But
it's at the bottom of a pond somewhere.
Barry Allen says, hey, maybe Gardner Fox... This writer who wrote about you, he must have had some vibrational tune in to this other universe. And that's why he started writing about... So apparently there is a Gardner Fox in Barry Allen's world writing stories about Jay Garrick, just as he did in ours.
Right. But somehow those stories get over to the other universe.
You mean ours?
Wow.
See, this is when it gets tricky, and that's why DC Comics has to start numbering these worlds. Eventually, Barry Allen's world, where most DC Comics take place, is Earth 1. But they can, apparently, like The Flash, travel back and forth to the World War II era stuff, which becomes Earth 2, confusingly, because it's older.
Right.
We live on Earth Prime, which is later revealed to be a different universe where comic books, heroes don't exist. It's a fictional construct.
But we can read the adventures of these true heroes that live in other universes.
Yes, on Earth, in Earth Prime, it's understood that you can travel back and forth. Although in my life, I've never seen a comic book hero from a different universe just pop up by vibrating his molecules.
No, I've never even seen one go through a wall by vibrating their molecules.
So I've been hanging out on the wrong parts of Earth Prime.
So a lot of this, it feels like during the creative process, I could imagine sitting at the typewriter and having a brainstorm where you think, oh, this is a great idea.
I should have him meet my other guy.
Yeah, this will be funny. And thinking it through just enough in the 3 hours it takes you to write the connective tissue.
These guys are writing on, you know, for on deadline.
Yeah.
Like none of this stuff is well thought out. And none of them are thinking there are going to be $100 million movies made of these in 50 years.
Or that I'm going to have to support this idea, that it's going monthly. To have to be internally yeah. consistent across 1,000 different platforms forever. Mm-hmm. And so when that sort of stuff starts getting stapled onto it, as it leaves the hands of its creator, and at first then becomes the responsibility of a committee,
an editorial group,
who somebody at that level waves their hands and goes, all right, there's two Earths, which is complete cop out, right? They could have, you know, if they'd really put their imaginative gears to work, mm-hmm. maybe found, I mean, it just as easily could have found a different direction to go in. But now we're standing atop a castle made out of sugar bread, of 60 years worth of people stapling on explanations.
Monthly comics, everybody wanting to add their own little take and filigree on it. So it gets more and more baroque and more detailed and complicated.
And it seems like the fan community of this world is hyper protective and super like, well, actually about it.
Yes, because it's a fun shibboleth that you're not one of these casuals. You're not just a kid in Aquaman underoos. You understand the difference between Earth 1, Earth 2.
I see.
Like, they like the complexity of the continuity, and they don't like when there's contradictions and errors.
And so it must be rife with contradictions and errors.
Okay, that's what happens here. Just as an aside, you know, obviously, I don't want to imply that Gardner Fox invented the idea of parallel universes just by the day he had the Flash.
Who did vibrate. Invent the concept of parallel universes?
I mean, it depends on how far you go back. I mean,
let's set the Wayback Machine to all the way back.
Every time I go to a movie, I think this movie must take place in a parallel universe because nobody sees Julia Roberts' character and says, hey, you look like Julia Roberts.
Right.
So when you think about it, all movies kind of by popular agreement have to take place by covert agreement, tacit agreement have to take place in some other universe in which
Julia
Roberts doesn't exist.
Except for movies where Julia Roberts makes a cameo.
Right. Oceans 12 is the only exception.
Or like The Player, right? Which was famously full of cameos where everybody played themselves.
But I think in general, people would look at art or read a book and think, this is a depiction of my world, but it's just some corner of it that has the Three Musketeers in it or whatever.
Right, right.
The idea that there could be a world parallel to ours, you know, one possible precursor would be in the classical era. Livy, the Roman historian, spent a couple paragraphs in one of his history books asking, hey, what would have happened if Alexander the Great had managed to invade Rome?
Oh, okay. So great. Alternate histories.
He invents alternate history there.
Yeah.
And he's not imagining a world, you know, he's not kind of setting a story there. He's just saying, hey, here's what might have happened. Here's the most likely outcome of that battle.
Right.
But that gets that kind of thing gets very complicated and baroque as history goes on. In 1836, a French author writes a Histoire de la Monarchie Universelle, History of the Universal Monarchy, which imagines Napoleon successfully, his campaign of Russia is successful, and as a result, he becomes the master of Europe.
Right.
What would and of course this is a Frenchman.
Pax Napoleon.
Right. A Frenchman imagining a French-centric Europe.
Can you imagine?
And you see that into the 30s.
I kind of like it, actually.
Well, in America, it becomes a lot of Civil War nostalgia.
Right.
To this day, a lot of this kind of Harry Turtledove alternate history stuff is, but what if the Civil War had been won by the Confederacy? What if the Nazis had won World War II?
Sure. I mean, I actually play that out a lot. My favorite is, what if Hitler had stopped at the Sudetenland?
Like he had observed his pact with Chamberlain.
What if Chamberlain was the hero of history, and Hitler had turned his attention to having the Germans manufacture microphones and and compact cars.
Do they still take out Russia, or are they?
No. Oh. That's it.
They just want to have a little fascist state in the middle of Europe.
Yeah. What he said he wanted, which was an Anschluss with Austria.
I like how your fantasy is an honest Hitler
and a reestablishment of Prussia.
I like a straightforward Hitler who makes promises and keeps
them. And then you know what? And then he becomes the original sort of German Zionist, and we start an Israeli state, but in Arizona.
Oh, he creates a homeland because he wants them out.
Wants them out, but it's all peaceful. There's no death and destruction. Actually, you know, this was the topic of a Michael Chabon novel.
Sure, where but it's in Alaska.
It's
right?
In Alaska, right?
I like how you're making fun of intricate superhero universes.
Listen,
but you have a much more crazy one, like in your head, ready to go.
I spent a lot of time thinking about the politics of the 1950s if there'd been no World War II.
So alternate history is one with a single point of divergence.
Right.
Becomes a popular genre, and today it's often used to tie into time travel stories because that can become the point of divergence.
Right.
I don't want to talk to you about time travel.
No, don't talk to me about time travel.
Another data point to look at here would be the Flatland story that we discussed in the Tesseract episode, mm-hmm. kind of an imaginary, didactic, two-dimensional universe. So imagining what would a world be like if it had these foundational physical laws go. And a lot of fantasy fiction, kind of, that's the implicit deal we're making. Like, hey, what if there was actually magic in Wales? Boom. Or, you know, what if there were dragons? Boom.
But there's a lot of desire, and I kind of sympathize with it, to have all of these alternate universes share a universe.
You're Tommy Westfall here.
Right? I mean, it's really, it's...
Do you not like the inconsistency of it? It seems messy to you?
No, I mean, I understand the desire to have the Game of Thrones universe and Led Zeppelin 2 and, you know, and the Boeing 747 all be part of a continuous thing that doesn't require that we walk through a portal of someone's imagination that has a sign over the door that says, I invented this world.
There should be a geography that gets you from one to the other.
Right. And it's why Star Wars was so effective at setting itself in a galaxy far, far away a long time ago.
As a kid, that really spoke to me.
It did, I think, to me too.
Like, hey, this is real, but it's just happening in a different place and time.
And my daughter and I have had that conversation. Like, you know, that's a long time ago. And she's like, I know. And then we both sit and just kind of stare at the wall like, right. And Battlestar Galactica did it too. It was a popular way of displacing.
Right. They have a mythical Earth that they're trying to get back to.
But it suggests that technology, I mean, what it does is it allows us to say, oh, UFOs are real and microwave ovens arrived on the scene because maybe that's found technology. Left over from a Battlestar Galactica, you know, like the wonderful thing in Star Trek when Voyager comes back.
Sure.
All that.
Star Trek couldn't stay away from the time travel. Like they kept going back to the 60s.
I know. Cause they like the haircuts.
But I like the Voyager. I do like when Voyager comes back. I feel like nobody's as into that moment as I am. Like, whoa, what a twist.
I was really into that. Tear came to my eye for poor little Voyager that was coming back to destroy Earth.
It just wanted to like chat with aliens. But so when pulp science fiction becomes a going concern in the 30s and 40s, of course, you know, they really embrace what the mechanisms of this might be. You know, if the idea that there are parallel time streams out there, could we access them? Could you go back and forth? You know, what would happen if one diverged? Could you go back and make a different one diverge? All the greats, Asimov and Heinlein and all these guys write groundbreaking stories considering, because it's just irresistible.
Yeah, it is.
An alternate world with a slightly different rules. Everything's the same, but what if there's, you know, flying cars? Or what if, you know, you met yourself, but it's a version of yourself that became a dictator through time travel.
But for an author or a creator to play in that sandbox and then put it aside and go play in another sandbox is kind of one thing. But for those of us that are the consumers that are left, it's very hard, I think, to shut the door on the last book and start the next book and not want the world that was created in your mind to persevere.
It's why fan fiction blossoms.
Right.
Right. You can't let go of the world. You just want more of it. You want more of that feeling you had when you first saw Tatooine or read about the Shire, right?
Right.
And I think that's why Earth 2 is kind of special. You know, there's all these precursors to this. The pulps were full of parallel timelines. Like, nobody's seeing Flash meet another Flash. You know, a little kid might have been like, whoa. But anybody who'd been reading, you know, Fantastic Space Adventures magazine would recognize the trope. But Earth 2, like you said, was sustained by a committee of people for decades.
Right.
So, you know, Ray Bradbury writes a story about the butterfly wing changing, you know, stepping on a butterfly and it changes history. And that kind of enters popular culture. But, you know, that's, you know, 5,000 words. Earth 2 continues to age and grow with its audience. After Flash of Two Worlds was a hit, it started to become an annual affair where the Justice League, kind of the Barry Allen era crime fighters, would meet up with the Justice Society, their World War II era predecessors, and they would cross from Earth 1 into Earth 2 and have an annual team up. This begins with Crisis on Earth 2.
They did it through what? A door?
Often the Flash would vibrate them in.
Oh, the Flash. He vibrates them in. He's like a guy buying a velvet rope.
Exactly. He's like you're
getting him into the club.
But this starts to become very tricky. You've mentioned that there would probably be a lot of loose ends here, and it starts to annoy these detail conscious fans. You know, keep in mind that both of, you know, while superheroes came out of style and then back in and then circled back and started hanging around with their original selves, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman have been publishing continuously. So that makes it kind of tricky. Like Superman, like Jay Garrick and Barry Allen don't know each other and consider that one considers the other a fictional character, and yet they both know Superman? How does that even work?
Right.
So it's decided that obviously Earth 1 and Earth 2 both have a Superman, a Batman, and a Wonder Woman.
Whoa.
So there's Superman of Earth 1, the one we know, and then there's Superman of Earth 2.
Do they have different qualities?
Slightly. Of course they don't, because their stories overlap. Like from 1940 to 1956, everything that happened to Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman
happened to both Superman, theoretically Batman, happened and to, Wonder Woman.
To both, we assume. Yeah, Wonder Woman, we assume.
I get it.
And then the same impulse that made creators want to create Earth 1 and 2 leads to more. There's got to be an Earth 3 where the Justice League is evil.
Sure.
There's got to be an Earth X where the characters, these different World War II characters from another publisher that we've acquired live. There's got to be Earth S where the Captain Marvel, the Shazam characters live. There's got to be Earth Prime where we live. And the interesting thing about having a Superman of Earth 2 is that, you know, he was having his adventures in the 40s. Which means as the years go on and these crossovers continue into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, our characters don't age. Barry Allen, the new Flash, and our Superman and Batman are perpetually youthful.
Right.
But these other guys are stuck in World War II.
Oh.
So.
Well, they don't age either. They're just stuck there.
Well, no. Their origins are stuck in World War II, so they are aging.
Oh, there are old Batman?
Yes. Like, so the main, you were asking about the differences. The main difference between Superman and Superman of Earth 2 is that, like, he married Lois Lane and retired. Like,
but we never see those comic books except
when our guys visit them.
Right. A component of Superman, yes. World 1.
Yes.
Earth 1.
And so this becomes even more complicated. Batman of Earth 2 marries Catwoman of Earth 2.
Hello.
Retires. They have a kid. As we get into the 60s and 70s, there can be a new generation. So they have a kid who fights crime as the Huntress. Okay. Batman of Earth 2 eventually dies and is replaced by Robin of Earth 2. She shows up. She doesn't get her own comic generally, but she shows up as a guest star in some kind of universe crossing way. Somebody has to vibrate molecules so she can meet our heroes.
Because it seems like she's ripe for her own property.
Sure. And that happens also in the Superman universe where... when he meets his Kryptonian cousin, in our world, that would be Supergirl. On Earth 2, that becomes Power Girl. So you have these very kind of popular comic book characters who are in a second universe somewhere having their own parallel adventures.
So now my question is, one of the things that's hard for me about digesting superhero stuff is that part of the appeal of any narrative work is that there are some stakes, right? Some reason that I care about, and to give my time over to a fictional character, product of someone else's imagination, they're taking me on a journey. If that journey seems unreal, why would I spend time there? Mm-hmm. If a person is bulletproof or whatever, there has to be something else that counteracts their invincibility that makes them real enough that I can take something away from it.
That's why you like Spider-Man. He's not in Metropolis. He's in our New York.
Yeah. And Spider-Man has troubles, real troubles. He's got pimples, right? And even Superman, for all of his superpowers, he struggles. Uh-huh. And one of his struggles is that he likes Lois and Lois doesn't like him. And he also...
likes Superman, but does not Clark.
Right, not Clark. And he's a nerd and he can't quite... You know, he's always tripping over his
shoes. His whole planet died.
His planet died. His parents are dead.
Kryptonite makes him bozo.
That's right. So there, you know, Superman's got some flaws or whatever. But if you're super deep into a world that's happening in an alternate universe,
right,
that could be wiped off the face of the terrain, not only by some cataclysm, but just by the fact that the Flash can no longer vibrate himself over there. Like, or that it's a component of a billion other universes where other superpower girls are doing superpower things. Where do you as a fan grip your toes and get some purchase on like giving a good goddamn?
Yeah. There would certainly be less identification with these alternate universe versions. I mean, it's right in the name. This isn't your Batman. This is Batman of Earth 2.
Right. This is Batman with a mustache.
He's a fun supporting character, I guess, is how you would think of him.
I can see the authors feeling liberated by not having to conform to really any rules.
Well, they can't, you know, the real Batman can't change at all. It's serial fiction. It's got a reboot for next month.
Right.
But the other guys can actually change and grow.
But as soon as you take away any rules that govern structures, yeah. I mean, Batman's got to wear a costume that looks like a bat, I guess. As soon as you get into a Batman that doesn't have a bat as a component of his logo, then you're into an alternate universe where something's changed.
What even is Batman?
What even is Batman? But like the Spider-Verse has Spider-Man. I'm looking this up now because I do not have this on hand. Spider-Man.
There's got to be six or seven in that movie, right?
There's Superior Spider-Man, okay, which is a different kind of Spider-Man. There's Spider-Woman. There's Silk. There's Kane. There's Spider-Gwen. Spider-Girl. There's Ultimate Spider-Man, which has got to be an evolution beyond Superior Spider-Man.
That's Miles. That's our Spider-Man of color.
Miles Morales. There's the Black Widow. There's Ultimate Spider-Woman.
Don't forget the...
Jessica Drew.
The pig. There's John Mulaney's pig guy. Spider-Ham.
Spider-Man 2099. There's Spider-Girl, which is May Mayday Parker.
That's and his alternate universe daughter from the future.
Right. So there's a lot of spider peoples. But they all have spider somewhere in the name, right?
does that sell it enough for you?
That's the thing. Is that it? Is that the only glue?
That kind of is the only glue. And a lot of this baggage you're talking about does start to accumulate over time. And it's eventually what dooms Earth 2, I think.
It's like arsenic poisoning, right? After a while, yes. it's a little bit...
A little bit's great.
Great, but then
I love to have some arsenic in my water.
It stores up in your bones.
Well, I think it became hard for new fans. You know, right. Like the old fans, like I was saying, it's a shibboleth. They love the fact that, oh, maybe we're going to check in with Huntress and Catwoman of Earth 2. But to a new fan, you're like, wait, what?
Catwoman Earth 2?
I don't even know what Earth 1 is.
I think that was always me, even though I was
There's
there.
There's a learning curve?
I was there in the 70s, book? But I couldn't rock it.
In the 70s and 80s, there is some attempt to actually make comics that take place in Earth 2. Like Roy Thomas, a kind of founding member of the comic book fan community who loved all these old comics, switches from Marvel to DC, and he gets permission to start setting actual comic books on Earth 2. So there's a Justice Society
comic.
Roy Thomas,
not Roy Thomas Baker.
No, I don't know who that is.
Roy Thomas Baker produced like the Queen Bohemian Rhapsody album and the Cars and stuff like
He's
that.
He's a subset of Roy Thomas Baker. So, he's Roy Thomas Baker of Earth 2, basically. No, he's a guy who was like Stan Lee's right-hand man at Marvel. But when he switches over to DC, he wants to make comics about these Golden Age guys he loves. So he makes new Justice Society comics and a new comic about their kids. So it's like the second generation of Earth 2 guys. So DC is publishing new comics set in a different Earth. And... like you say, it starts to get complicated. Like, here are some of the problems. we've mentioned that Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman were published continuously through both the World War II era and the Golden and the Silver Ages. At what point do their comics switch over from being about Batman of Earth 2 to Batman of Earth 1?
Yeah. Where's
yeah, well, there's got to be a dividing point.
A switchover, right?
But where is it? Like, to this day, it's kind of like a...
Oh, hang on.
And it gets even worse.
There's a pivot point.
It gets even worse. If characters in the Silver Age can read about the Golden Age guys and have all those comics that we had...
But it's been the same person the whole time.
Yes, doesn't that mean they know that Batman is Bruce Wayne and that Superman is Clark Kent?
Hey!
They should just look at their old comics and be like, oh, right.
Exposed!
And then when Superman appeared on Earth One, how come nobody was like, oh yeah, this is Clark Kent, I read about him in the 40s. And then wouldn't Clark Kent be like, whoa, this is weird.
Everybody knows about me already.
I was an older dude in the 40s?
Come on.
In now a comic book?
Now I'm just feeling really seasick.
So this pushes plausibility to the breaking point. And in 1984, Marvel is way ahead in the market. Their more hipper contemporary comics, superhero comics, are just killing DC, and particularly the X-Men.
Yeah, X-Men.
They're like the kind of the angsty outcast. They push the Spider-Man pimple worries into the kind of the, you know, they're a persecuted minority.
Yeah,
so it's easy to identify. It's your queer readers love it. They know what it's like to suddenly get weird knowledge about yourself in your teens that makes you different. You know, readers of color love they're a persecuted minority that out of, you know, the out of touch white politicians are always persecuting.
I remember I felt a little resurgence with the early X-Men stuff. You know, I'd been way out of comics, but I got into those first X-Men.
College kids started reading comics again.
Yeah,
I think.
And I was in college, and it was pretty cool. I enjoyed that stuff a lot.
And so DC just seems even more hopelessly square than usual. Their one comic that kind of keeps up with the X-Men is the new Teen Titans.
Yeah, and that just sounded like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to me.
It was their dopiest. It was all their kid sidekicks. It was Aquaman sidekick and Wonder Woman sidekick. But they had
a new
writer, right? All their cousin Olivers had kind of been hipped up by a Marvel guy named Marv Wolfman, who had come over and was kind of writing his own version of the X-Men with Robin and all these other sidekicks.
He was a Marvel guy named Marv.
Yeah, it was short for Marvel guy. So he's got a lot of Clark, because he's the only guy at DC writing anything that young people want to read. And he and his Teen Titans collaborator, artist George Perez, have an idea. They're going to write a series that kills off the multiverse.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to get rid of Earth 2 and Earth S and Earth X and everything. And they're going to simplify DC comics so that new readers will finally not have to deal with all this Catwoman of Earth 2 nonsense.
Burn it down.
Burn it to the ground and start over. And
it all turned out to be a dream in Tommy Westfall's snow globe.
Well, they almost do something as metatextual as that. It becomes, since all the previous crossovers have been Crisis on Earth 2, Crisis on Earth X, Marv Wolfman proposes a Crisis on Infinite Earths, in which every Earth out there in the multiverse faces the same existential threat. And it's a very metatextual premise whereby a white wall of nothingness will engulf all these worlds, like kind of like the blank page.
Well, I'm looking for that every single morning.
Right.
Please, white wall of nothingness.
But in a comic book, what you see is, you know, stuff literally getting erased, you know, like a white page erases ink lines.
Meta.
It's very meta. And there becomes a race of powerful guardian aliens keeping an eye on the continuity, not unlike a comic book editorial staff, who decide they want to prune and simplify certain things and preserve others.
Is the big blue penis god from Watchmen playing a role in this at all?
He is still just a twinkle in Alan Moore's eye at this point.
Okay.
But yeah, today, actually, that he is being used for the same kind of meta purposes in some DC comics. And instead of just destroying all the other Earths and leaving Earth 1, you don't want to do that because then you'll lose your Huntress, your Power Girl,
right.
All your World War II guys. So the idea, Marv's idea, is to merge them all into one new Earth.
How many Batmans can one Earth contain?
Right. So it becomes a different kind of plausibility pushing nightmare of pushing all these stories together in a way that now retroactively makes it. It's the invention of what we call retroactive continuity, saying that things happened one way, even though to readers who had those comics in the 50s, we know they didn't.
Huh.
So all of the DC Earths get combined into a new Earth where people remember the World War II heroes,
But don't remember them getting old and dying?
They did, but there was never two of anyone.
Oh.
Like when the new Flash came, it was just a different guy who still remembered the old guy who was just 20 years older, you know, or a little bit older.
But didn't have to deal with copyright issues when he took Flash's right. costume and just started wearing it.
Exactly. There is a Huntress, but she's not Batman's kid. She's got some new mob-related origin. There is a Power Girl, but she has an Aquaman-related origin. Does anybody remember the old stuff? Like, does Superman remember when he used to hang out with other Superman? It's kind of editorially unclear.
Does anyone remember laughter?
Best not to look too closely. Roy Thomas is told that his beloved JSA and their kids will all be untouched.
Oh.
But it turns out, no.
Like,
Marv Wolfman decides to lower the boom.
They get bermed, too.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, whole little corners of the DC universe. The books continue, but suddenly in a new universe where some things happened and some things didn't. And it becomes a chance to kind of update it for the 80s. And get rid of stuff that seems old-timey and embarrassing.
Did they get rid of any of the stuff that was new-timey and embarrassing?
Because like,
it seems
for
like
example,
there was a lot more of that.
When Wonder Woman had her 70s feminist Gloria Steinem era?
Or just the Teen Titans or whatever. That seems like that all could have gone.
A lot of that stuff goes away. Yeah, like there was never a Superboy, for example, in these new comics. Like right. Superman never dressed up as a superhero as a kid, for example. So stuff like that, that seems a little, it would be cleaner without it. So this is a chance to actually get rid of it. They think it's going to be simple, but actually it starts a 20-year era of trying to figure out what really happened. Like what the DC Comics universe should look like, which things were real, which things were not. And they're constantly tweaking it and being like, oops, there's been another threat to the cosmos. And that will let us reboot the following characters. Or, oh, there's a some villain has created a little separate universe, and that lets us say that this stuff really happened, but this stuff didn't. So it, you know, the editorial hands are very clear in all these supposedly in story events,
right?
And in fact, they finally bailed on the whole thing, in recent years, sometime in the early 2000s, I think they said, no, actually there is a multiverse now there's an Earth 2 all over again. So the simplicity only lasted 20 years. But I would say that the sustained popularity of creating this parallel Earth for comic book fans for 20 years, it changed the way our generation thinks about fiction and maybe even the way we think about reality.
Go on.
Well, think about how baked in this idea of alternate realities now is. Like, you know, Gardner Fox really had to explain all kinds of crazy vibrational stuff to get us on board with a second Flash. And today, it's just a staple of, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, there's a 10-second, hey, I'm a different Spider-Man. And then, boom, we're into a new Spider-Man. And that audiences are sophisticated enough to go with that.
You know, it's funny because it all is happening contemporaneously with the dawn and rise of the idea of cultural relativity.
Sure, there could be a second Spider-Man and he could have different values than the old-timey one.
That's right. And you cannot judge the new Spider-Man's values based on the values of the old Spider-Man's cultural world.
It's very helpful when the old icons are problematic or troubled in some way, you right. know, like,
or just old.
Yeah, like exactly.
Full on, not even.
If you think of them as your grandpa's Superman or Tarzan or Dracula, let's have one for a new era that speaks to youth culture. But you see this not just in geek culture, but it's mainstream. You know, like art films will have this conceit of two different parallel versions of, you know, right. the double life of Veronique or whatever. You just take it for granted that there can be this woman and her alternate universe version who made a different decision. Prestige TV, like The Man in the High Castle, will just take it as read that there's one world in which the Nazis won and one world in which they lost, and you just have to roll with it.
We see it, as you were saying earlier, like all movies kind of operate in a parallel universe, but you go to see Inglourious Basterds.
And it doesn't have to seem like a World War II.
It's a World War II, and the scary parts of it and the horrifying parts of it are...
Tarantino's a good example. Like, his movie this year is set in an alternate reality where the Manson murders go differently. And that's, it's never stated. It just unveils differently. And Rod Serling never appears to be like, what if Sharon right. Tate didn't die?
Right.
There's a novel this year, Ian McEwan, you know, maybe the finest literary novelist in Britain right now, wrote a book that about artificial intelligence that doesn't have to be set in an alternate world, but he just thought it would be fun. So it's an alternate world where Britain loses the Falklands War. I think Alan Turing doesn't commit suicide. So that's why Britain is an advanced computer culture. And nobody ever says this is a different world. You just kind of gradually find out with little clues in the book what's different than our universe, and it's kind of a source of fun.
Well, and like we've been saying throughout the show, I feel like from the standpoint of a writer, why not? Sure. Super fun, because writing is creative and
lets you change more decisions, right?
Do what you want. I think in the past, like Tarantino's book or Tarantino's movie about the Manson murders going differently, I think traditionally a writer would have taken the Manson murders as inspiration,
fictionalized it,
and changed all the names and details and made a different story that the savvy reader would go, oh, this is referencing the Manson murders. But it didn't. But the writer wouldn't have said, no, this is the Manson murders in an alternate universe.
And it gives you some verisimilitude to think, I'm there. I'm looking at the actual houses and real characters making real Westerns that you wouldn't have had if it's kind of winky-winky.
It takes the TV moviness out of it.
Yeah.
But it introduces the new kind of quandary of alternate universe equals...
Yeah,
like, or creates like alternate truth.
I saw that criticism of the Tarantino movie. Like, when it's all done, what does this add up to? It's just a wish fulfillment fantasy of the director who would like to have seen history go different.
And that's the same with Inglourious Basterds.
And the movie ends, and in our world, Sharon Tate's still dead.
Yeah, but the thing is, yeah, there are real people in that universe making real choices, moral choices, and those moral choices and those real lives get turned into comic book. Those people have become marionettes for the delight of the author for some period, and then they get abandoned. Right. I mean, that was my critique my criticism, I guess, of Inglourious Basterds was 6 million Jews still died in that universe and no comment was made about them except that Hitler gets shot in the face 50 times at the end of the movie.
Should I really feel okay that Django, you know, should I really, is there any kind of catharsis in Django Unchained if it doesn't actually change how slavery happened?
So it does feel, it's
unearned. Yeah.
It feels masturbatory, but also like an unnecessary conceit. Given that literature allows one to write whatever one wants, so why bother? I mean, if you're going to create a universe, go the extra distance and call it Metropolis even.
A single point of divergence is maybe less creative.
Right. Like do a little bit more work and create a war that didn't happen and then set your morality play within it. Rather than take like basically the lazy, let history do all the heavy lifting for you.
That was Tolkien's innovation, right? Which is that I'm just going to drop you into this world totally unlike ours, and you're going to have to just explore it with the guys.
Right, or Dune or any of the any great science fiction is world creating rather than just scene creating.
I would go further than, you know, we've talked a lot about how this changed art, kind of this whole Earth to Star Trek mirror universe innovation, how it changed art, but I think it's kind of changed how a rising generation actually thinks about the world. Like, I think we think about reality different now that we just kind of all assume that there are parallel universes. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but reading the Ray Bradbury story where Stepping on the Butterfly puts a fascist government in power millions of years later, it really makes me think about how small acts can snowball. And we even use the metaphor of the butterfly effect.
We do it all the time. I mean, I say butterfly effect once a week.
Does it make you more, it kind of makes me more mindful of what I do, you know, now that I think that, you know, if one unkind word to my kids could, you know, just put them in a bad mood for the day or make them pass along that mood to others.
I use the butterfly effect as a teaching thing with my kid, which is, I'm basically trying to say to her, if you are nice and are nice to people, that niceness is distributive. And if you're mean, you have no idea how that meanness ends up creating meanness down the road for somebody you'll never meet.
So that awareness of, you know, potential possible alternate timelines where you're nice or mean actually maybe creates a more mindful, enlightened public.
And that's what's so beautiful about that short story. And that, you know, yeah, that was a moment of a writer's imagination that he didn't belabor. He didn't create a 600 episode series about it. He just had the idea. He elucidated it and got out. Right.
But think of these other manifestations of it. Like, I don't think we'll do a whole show about the Mandela effect, but are you aware of this idea that when people have remember the past wrongly, they now, instead of saying, oh, I remembered the past wrongly, they now say, oh, cool, I come from a parallel universe where,
whoa,
X, where Berenstain is spelled differently,
no,
or where Sinbad, wow, made a movie where he was a genie, or Nelson Mandela died in prison.
No. You don't get to do that.
Because there's common they're so confident,
yeah,
that this is how the universe works, that there is a multiverse.
Right, that instead of saying, you know, memory's
tricky. It's funny how a bunch of people can start to think they saw that edited scene and deleted scene from Star Wars.
Right.
Instead, they now think, no, I came from a world where we actually do follow Luke on Tatooine before we don't switch over to the droids, you know?
It's just a way for people to never be wrong.
Yeah, so this can reinforce the worst things about us as well. And I don't know, to me, the one I hear the most is kind of the trope of the good universe versus the darkest timeline. Do you see this online?
I think there's I may be editing for content.
I think there's a 2011 episode of Community that raises the idea that there are, you know, good timelines and disastrous ones, utopias and dystopias. And, you know, certain inflection points can lead you into a good universe and a bad universe. You know, there's dark timelines.
Is Chevy Chase in this episode?
I think it's early enough that it has Chevy Chase.
All right.
Does that make it a dark timeline for
it
you?
It does.
But I started to see it like when Trump won in 2016, people started to use this unironically and uncritically and be like, we're in the darkest timeline, you know, like.
There's a West Wing version of the United States.
Yes.
That's percolating along with Jed Bartlett.
People are very aware. People are checking in from the universe where Hillary won.
Well, that is online. That is the West Wing thing, right? I mean, throughout,
yes,
the Bush administration, we had,
yep,
Jed Bartlett to comfort us at night.
And I almost think it's a false comfort. You know, maybe it makes you less activist if you can just think, no, I can just, instead of thinking about all this, I can turn on the West Wing and imagine,
right,
that good, smart, benevolent liberals are in command and everything's going to be fine.
Oh, no.
But on the other hand, maybe it is kind of hopeful, you know, the idea that, you know, if nothing else, it suggests there could be a better world or a better place.
Yeah, but I feel like there has always been hope and there's always been a desire to make the world a better place without
needing a cosmology of it?
Yeah, without, yeah, sort of needing to clutch your whoobie through the bad times. I mean, you have to kind of face the bad times if you're sincere about making the world a better place.
Agree 100%. Just in closing, what's interesting is that since Earth 2 kind of cemented our idea of parallel Earths, the science has kind of come along with it. Like, the science followed the science fiction in this case.
Yeah, but is this the science that was reading about the science of Earth 2 and then yeah, discovering
Did
science?
Did they read in a comic book? Like, Hugh Everett proposed in 1957 what is called, what we now call the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory.
Right.
Which kind of solves the problem of, well, if you know, light sometimes acts as a particle and sometimes acts as a wave, and this is all indeterminate at a quantum level until it's examined, does that mean that things change every time you examine it? It's the paradox that leads to Schrodinger's cat.
Right.
Like, the cat is both alive and dead until the examiner opens the box and the waveform collapses. And one way to resolve that seeming paradox is just to say, oh, every time the waveform collapses,
reality splits,
yeah, and Earth 2 or Earth 2 million gets created, one where the cat's alive and one where the cat's dead. And so the universe is constantly branching in a beautiful Spideyverse shape. And we just happen to be living in the one we know, but there's an infinite multiverse out there. So it's weird that there is now a scientific backing for what started out as a kind of a stupid editorial conceit.
So it's fractals. And maybe it's not a stupid editorial conceit. Maybe it is our nature to do.
Yes, Gardner Fox did tune into another universe when he wrote Flash of Two Worlds.
Gardner Fox was just the cat.
Or maybe he was just
the box.
Maybe he was just dropping acid.
And that concludes Earth 2, entry 391.RV2101, certificate number 46819 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media exists across all multiverses and that you are listening to this program in all the many different universes that have been created from the time that Ken and I recorded it in this, our one solitary universe.
We definitely cropped out all the universes where we don't do a show.
And the thing is,
they're listening to nothing right now.
I will not allow that there are alternate Kens and Johns making this right now. I believe that we are the only ones making this. Now, subsequent to this, there are maybe potentially billions of Ken and Johns who have diverged from this point going forward. And different things happen. They answer different emails.
It's easier to imagine the future ones than the past ones.
But there cannot be other Kens and Johns.
You want to be the progenitor of all the other Johns.
Well, at least from this moment. Hmm. I do not allow that there is another John somewhere saying these very words. Only that there are other Johns that ended up kissing Lori Basler in 1980 and that had different lives. I believe that there are those Johns.
I see.
But you cannot have other Johns that simultaneously arrived at this very moment because the choice that they made to do something different was just like an hour ago. I suppose.
Yeah, what if they made a different choice, but they still did largely the same show?
Right. That's the problem, right?
What if I drank a slightly smaller swig of Dr. Pepper? Most of my choices during the entry were the same.
There are certainly some Johns that woke up this morning and other Kens were on their way over to those John's houses. I mean, I had no choice in you choosing this topic. I would have put the kibosh on it if I'd known it.
Here we go.
And so you would have already, you'd shown up here, but I would have stubbed my toe or something on the stairs, so I would be in a different mood. Maybe I would have had other thoughts. Okay, I'll allow that there are other versions of this show that even have this little speech in
them. And the problem is half of them are better. This is probably the medium one.
Boy.
What if
that's
we're
depressing.
Darkest timeline.
Anyway, this is the darkest timeline. To futurelings who have survived the great cataclysm when all universes, all Ken and John universes are forcibly combined.
Crisis on Infinite Omnibus.
Into one timeline. You can check against reality by going to our Twitter and Instagram handles. Well, Twitter and whatever, Facebook, other stuff, Omnibus Project, Ken Jennings, John Roderick, you can look for us. If you don't have the power to find us on the internet, I'm stunned that you are listening to a podcast. Maybe one of your children keyed this up for you, teed it up, in which case you're not going to go to Instagram.
Have your grandkids come over and subscribe to our social media feeds.
Please email us. Even if your grandkids set up your email, I bet you know how to use it. And you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can go to our Futurelings and Reddit fan communities, both called Futurelings. Or I'm sorry, our Facebook and Reddit communities, both called Futurelings. You can support our show on Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Please do. Please be one of the devoted and dedicated and you know, doing good in the world butterfly effect listeners who give what you can.
That's right. Money is a stressful thing, and it is scarce, and it is
And it's going to get scarcer for you after you donate.
That's right. It's often troubling, but it's also completely fake. Money is completely fake.
And think of the happiness you'll get every time you listen to a new entry in the omnibus thinking, maybe this would not have happened if not for my
I'm the butterfly.
My generous impulse.
My wings are the ones that are propelling Omnibus along life's path.
Thank you, butterfly people of the past.
And finally, you can send us real live things to confirm that we share a universe at P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155.
Is it your contention when you get electronic communication that it might be from another universe?
Yes, absolutely.
Every email you get, you think, is this really Ken or is this Ken of Earth 2?
I think the burden of proof to someone sending an email through a rip in the space-time continuum, it's much lower than someone putting something in a box and having it delivered by mail.
Hard to get them to verify. Hard to say. I mean, if I'm married to Catwoman, then you know it's not really me.
Here's what you don't do. Do not put a cat in a box and send it to us to confirm whether it's alive or dead.
It's true. We will not tell you what happens when the wave function collapses.
And we will not open the box. So the cat will remain alive.
In a state of quantum indeterminacy. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long Earth One will survive. We hope and pray that the crisis we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, if the anti-monitor combines all the Earths, then this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word to you. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omelettes.